Hello, it's The Week in Art. I'm Ben Luke. This week, we remember Richard Serra, who died on Tuesday, plus an Expressionist art special, Ketta Kollwitz at the Museum of Modern Art in New York, and The Blue Rider at Tate Modern. Richard Serra, one of the greatest artists of the past 50 years, a linchpin of the post-minimalist scene in late 1960s and early 1970s New York, and later the creator of vast steel ellipses and spirals, died on Tuesday. We mark the passing of this titan of sculpture with Donna DeSalvo, the senior adjunct curator of special projects at the Deer Foundation, whose Beacon Space has several major works by Serra on permanent view. There are a host of exhibitions focusing on expressionist art in the US and Europe in 2024, and in this episode we focus on two of them. The first ever Ketta Kollwitz retrospective in New York is taking place at the Museum of Modern Art, or MoMA, while other shows dedicated to her are taking place in Frankfurt and Stockholm. I speak to Star Figura, the curator of MoMA's show, which opens this weekend, about Kollwitz's extraordinary work and life. Then I speak to Natalia Sidlina, who's the curator of expressionists Kandinsky, Munter and The Blue Rider, a major survey opening next month of the German Expressionist group, which looks anew at the deep friendships that formed the basis of the collective, their international outlook, and their multidisciplinary output. You can subscribe to the art newspaper at theartnewspaper.com and also to this podcast and our sister podcast, A Brush With, wherever you're listening. A Brush With returned this week with an in-depth conversation with Shazia Sikander. Please also give us a rating or review on Apple Podcasts. Now, immediately as the news broke that Richard Serra had died in Orient, New York on Tuesday at the age of 85, newspapers, the airwaves and social media were filled with artists, museum directors and curators hailing him as one of the greatest sculptors of his era. One of his dealers, David Zwirner, went so far as to say that Serra was one of the greatest artists, period. Among the most dramatic displays of Serra's work is in the Deer Art Foundation site at Beacon in New York, where a cluster of his sculptures, including his early landmark work Scatterpiece from 1967 and several more recent works, are housed permanently. Among them is a group of torqued ellipses, the vast twisting forms that became the hallmark of Serra's last three decades. And I spoke to Donna DeSalvo, the senior adjunct curator of special projects at the Deer Foundation, about them. Donna, it's difficult to estimate how important Richard Serra is to the history of sculpture in the US and indeed art in recent US history, isn't it?
Oh, yes. And I would say the US and internationally. There's no doubt that he redefined what a sculpture could be. Not only the redefining it in terms of structure, but its materiality as well. And I think that there are so many artists, both of his generation, his contemporaries, as well as subsequent generations, that speak about his work, look to his work. And, you know, he is certainly one of the great artists and sculptors of the 20th and into the 21st century.
It's important to stress that he came from a period in New York in terms of his artistic formation that is so influential right the way through the culture. Now, you've written and curated about this period a lot. Tell us a bit about that period, because it was an incredibly radical moment in the history of art, basically.
Well, you know, I think that it's so interesting to think back to that moment. I mean, you know, we weren't there, but that in some ways there were certain constraints that artists were pushing against coming out of, I think, of course, in the US, abstract expressionism, and then this divergent into so many things that were happening with pop art, with, of course, what became minimalism. And that had an impact all the way around on painting, on sculpture, redefining what a sculpture and a painting could be, right? One thinks of Rauschenberg's combines, for instance, and the relationship with the wall, and also the formal rigors of minimalism. So, you know, there were, in a way, kind of lanes, if you will, and then all of these things to respond both against and to take with those. You know, that's the interesting thing. It's never a clear break or rupture, but it's sort of building and rejecting simultaneously. And I think the other thing I often think about is, of course, 60s New York, 60s and 70s New York, where, you know, there were things that were happening eventually in the streets, on the rooftops, tremendous experimentation. And, you know, when you mentioned, I remember when we did Century City at Tate Modern, and I did the section on New York, and it was New York, the urban stage. So a place to perform, a performative space and an urban space, which also carried with it, I think, certain kind of materiality in terms of the type of materials, and you could go on a rooftop without worrying about insurance. And also that it wasn't about market, especially in that later 60s and into the 70s moment.
Yeah. New York was bankrupt.
Oh, yeah.
Artists were just free to do whatever they wanted, wherever they wanted to a certain degree.
Oh, yes. The famous headline, you know, is Ford to City Drop Dead, which kind of summed it all. Gerald Ford. Because the city, yes, New York was on the verge of bankruptcy.
One of the interesting things, I think, is that, of course, Serra is now much known and highly regarded for these enormous sculptures that he made. But I don't think he ever forgot the body in all of that, did he? Because, you know, we talk about that radical moment, which was so much about his early experiments with materials and his own body and so on. But he was also hugely influenced by contemporary dance in that period.
Oh, absolutely.
I don't think you can forget about that when you're walking in amongst the massive sculptures, you know.
No, you know, it's so interesting that I always think about that, of course, up at Dia Beacon, where we have, you know, an extraordinary installations of his work and the torqued ellipses and watching people move through those spaces. I've seen people break into dance. Like on some level, you know, they have a very visceral response to it. And it's, of course, incredibly wonderful to watch children who one might think would be terrified by the enormity, the angles, the materiality. But, you know, when you're a kid, I don't think you're thinking about at a certain age, like how heavy is the steel? I think adults sometimes are, you know, I've seen people not be able to go in or stop, but the body is always implied, I think, in all of Serra's work. You know, we're weighing in our mind, how much does it weigh? You know, the angle, will it drop? I mean, he's playing with all, you know, of those things, but I'm glad you bring that up because I also think those early pieces like Hand Catching Lead and, you know, Yvonne Rainer was doing the hand films in 66 and Serra does it in 68. And he was hanging out at Judson Church. And of course, one of his partners was Joan Jonas, who, you know, has a show at MoMA now. And I heard in a performance she did a couple of nights, I heard from some colleagues that she did a what amounted to a sort of a tribute actually to Serra during that performance.
Oh, how wonderful. And talking about the talked ellipses, one of the things I'm really conscious of is how it's a total experience in terms of, yes, you're aware of the sculptural materiality, you're aware of space and so on. But one thing that I found so striking when I was walking among them was sound. Mm-hmm. Again, that's crucial to Serra's inheritance. You know, he was connected to Philip Glass and to Steve Reich and others. And, you know, again, that sort of multidisciplinary moment, it seems to me really informed his work all the way through. He wasn't just a sculptor.
I agree, but I also agree with you that that's not always evident to people. He was also a filmmaker. You know, the films of Richard Serra. I mean, I remember at the Whitney, my colleague Chrissy Isles showed Television Delivers People. It's a collaboration. And what's so cool about it, it was a collaboration with Carlotta Faye Schulman in 1973. Mm. And they use the material of pop culture, elevator music, this very spare graphics. And it's really a critique of mass media and pop culture, this sort of rolling credits almost going, very numbing. So he was working on, many, many angles. And I don't know that that is as well known, especially to new generations, frankly, as it should be. One might say this sounds peculiar, but there's a deeply human element to that work, a classical element. I don't know if he would bristle at that term, but, you know, going back to the torqued ellipsis and knowing that it was inspired by the church designed by the Italian architect Francesco Borromini in 1646. Mm. So here you're going back to a Renaissance church that he visited several times. And what's so fascinating is that he gets that idea of the elliptical volume, twisting it.
Yeah.
And then he works with these lead models, which actually Dia has. And what I love is how he began to use computer technology. So you have this conflation of two ways of seeing, essentially, one with a Renaissance moment, one of the 20th century, that he merges together to be able to figure out the angles to bend that steel. And then, of course, that he actually finds a place. I think it was a place that made battleships to, you know, roll the steel and form it and twist it, you know, all the making. So it really works, you know, it's industrial, it's post-industrial. It also has a lot of cultural ramifications. And if I could just add one thing, I'm a huge fan of Hudson River landscape painting.
Mm.
With all its issues about the land that's being shown and who's not being shown in indigenous lands, mm-hmm. But a huge component of that work is about awe and terror, and that notion of the sublime that you see, of course, in Caspar David Friedrich. And I always think of that when I'm in those works, and especially Sarah's works that have that extraordinary mass and scale, that we're attracted to it. There's a danger. I mean, you can't help but look at those curved steels and those angles that I still scratch my head. I was not at DIA when they were installed, you know, and I always kind of look at them. But of course, I think everybody does. But that's, you know, a component of it. And so, you know, that's like a German romanticism atop an American transcendentalism. And so I think a lot about that vibe that you get when you're around something larger than yourself.
And it's important also that there's that deliverance into transcendence, especially in the double ellipse ones where you're going through the corridor and then you enter into this sort of central elliptical space. And there's a kind of release, wonderful release, which, and of course, I'm sure Richard Serra would not at all want any sort of religious connotations to it, but it is a kind of transcendent moment when you enter into that sort of releasing space.
Yeah, there's a sense of arrival when you get to that space. And I think it's in one of the some DIA literature that Lynn Cook actually talks about almost these spaces as a series of chapels, you know, how Sarah felt about that religious connotation. Although I, you know, from what I've read, I think he was an anti-religion. There is certainly, though, the relationships that one thinks of when you go into certain cathedrals that are larger than ourselves, that, you know, beckon to something beyond, something that we can't understand. But I'm always amazed, you know, when I watch people at DIA also have a relationship with the work that somehow I think comes back to themselves. And Sarah really talks about that. He really sees this transformative experience as a possibility to change, change oneself, change one's perception. And when it comes down to it, it's all about perception.
And he said, you are the subject, meaning us, you know, we are the subject.
Well, we are. Yeah, absolutely. We are the subject. He presents an object and then we are the ones that project our feelings, our interpretations on the work. He does direct us, you know, because some of the works, as you know, okay, you go forwards and backwards, but when you're within those relatively narrow corridors, it's a prescribed journey. And when you talk about the release, I think that's a great way to see it, especially when you are finding your way, you know, if it's the first time you've been, even if you've been multiple times, you have to, you're going and going, and then you kind of come into this open space. And, you know, there's a kind of a payoff, if you will.
Yeah.
So you go from serious control to a kind of freedom of looking up. I also love at different times of the day, how the light plays on those works, because there's so much natural light. You know, that space is where the trains originally came.
Yeah.
The Nabisco plant. And my understanding is they were the ones that then would terminate or go into the Nabisco plant in Chelsea. So, you know, there's also this other kind of industrial and now very post-industrial romanticism. Again, I don't know that Sarah would see it in that way. He might bristle at my description, but there's no doubt that that context for them, and of course, that's the nature of the DIA building, but that's an incredible space. And when light comes in, you can even see the mullions projected onto the steel. So it's constantly in motion.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I think that's the other thing, is that they're physically static, but they're perceptually moving.
And I think also one of the things that's remarkable about them is the ambition, because as you said, you know, he was using computer modeling. There were machines that had to be invented for him to kind of work a lot of it out. He's using battleship shipyards to build the things. It's really interesting to me that he began as a painter and then he saw Velázquez Las Meninas and basically said, I can't do this anymore. I can't. But for sculpture, he felt there were still possibilities and he really wanted to push those possibilities absolutely to the max.
Yes, which is what any great artist does. I mean, I think that's what art making is about at its best, which is to go to a place you haven't been before. And, you know, I think that Velázquez reference where he talks about being able to relate to the painting and the space of the painting, you know, conceptually to think about that, his relationship to the actual work must have been a great epiphany for him. And then, of course, I love all those works, the early works, the verb list, thinking drawing is a verb, and those early hand catching lead and the scatter pieces. And I mean, DIA is really fortunate to also have that scatter piece, which is made from rubber. And the idea that these pieces that he made really took their cues or their structure from the actual location. So you can watch, you know, where he's going with these experiments. And, you know, it doesn't begin with the giant works. Mm. I mean, I remember installing a work from that late 60s at the Whitney, a prop piece, which is lead, and it's propped up to the wall. And lead is very soft. So it's a very challenging piece, not easy to install. But yet you could argue that the beginnings, like that all of this is in the later works. But the ambition is, of course, ramped up, the capacity to work on that scale. And, you know, whether it's the work that then had to be dismantled, Tilted Arc, or works up in Iceland, or many of the works that he made in the landscape also, which I think have that vibe of the sublime. He bristles at the word monumental. And yet there is monumentality in the work. And I think it led to periods of anti-monument to a large extent. So there also has this response to his work amongst many artists as well, both then and now. Adi, it's great because over the years, there's been artists who, you know, like Anne Hamilton, who came to speak on Sarah, and many other artists who deeply admire the work. Even if they are, say, do we get into the masculine versus the feminine, which is always a dialogue that, you know, that has happened. Again, I think the fact that he had these relationships and collaborations with so many people, you know, he was not working in a vacuum at all. He was so conscious of what was going on. It's incredibly wonderful that we have this great legacy of Richard's work at Dia and really throughout the world. And we think about his family and Clara at this moment.
Donna, it's a pleasure to talk to you about such a great artist. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Ben.
Richard Serra's work is on long-term view across five galleries at Dia Beacon. Coming up, Kette Kollwitz at MoMA and Tate Modern's exhibition dedicated to the Blue Rider Group. That's after this week's News Bulletin. Nicholas Cullinan, the director of the National Portrait Gallery in London, has been appointed director of the British Museum, taking on an array of challenges at the world's oldest national museum after a theft scandal and amid calls for the Parthenon marbles to be returned to Greece. Cullinan led a major transformation at the National Portrait Gallery that met with critical and public acclaim. He's previously served as a curator at the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York and at Tate Modern, where he worked on the exhibition Henri Matisse, The Cutouts. He studied history of art at the Courtauld Institute. Cullinan says he looks forward to building on his successes at the National Portrait Gallery and, quote, collectively reimagining the British Museum for the widest possible audience and future generations. Meanwhile, the British Museum has been accused of locking the stable door after the horse has bolted, after it this week launched legal action against Peter Higgs, the curator accused of stealing up to 2,000 objects from its collection. Higgs, a long-standing curator who was promoted to acting keeper of the museum's Greek and Roman department, was sacked last year following revelations that a large number of objects had been damaged or gone missing. Martin Hennig, an expert in engraved gemstones, and the scholar and art dealer Itai Gradl had previously attempted to warn the museum about evidence they'd uncovered of items being stolen, but these warnings were dismissed. Higgs denies the allegations. Inigo Philbrick, the disgraced art dealer who pleaded guilty to carrying out an $86 million fraud and was sentenced to 7 years in prison, has been released. Philbrick opened his gallery in 2013 after serving as the head of secondary market sales at White Cube. In 2019, Philbrick's business suffered when the market for some of his preferred artists, such as Christopher Wall and Rudolf Stingel, began to cool. He then started to misrepresent the ownership of certain works for his benefit, sold shares of works to multiple investors, used some of those works to secure loans for himself, and forged consignment documents. In 2019, he defaulted on a $14 million loan, and just before multiple lawsuits against him became public, he fled the US for the Pacific island of Vanuatu, where he was arrested in 2020. In November 2021, he pleaded guilty to federal wire fraud charges, telling a Manhattan judge that he had done it for the money. You can read these stories and much more on the website or the app. Now, few artists have expressed human emotion as articulately and relentlessly as the German artist Kette Kollwitz. Born in the Prussian city of Königsberg, which is now Kaliningrad in Russia, in 1867, Kollwitz was based in Berlin from the 1890s through to the early 1940s, a turbulent period, of course, in German history, which included the transformative effects of industrialization and the two world wars. Kollwitz acutely observed the seismic effects of these and other events on the life of those around her as well as herself. She was committed to an art of real societal purpose throughout her life, giving visibility to the lives of working people and always exploring women's perspectives on social upheavals, past and present. This weekend, a major retrospective of Kollwitz's work opens at the Museum of Modern Art in New York, with around 120 drawings, prints and sculptures, including her four great print cycles, The Weaver's Revolt, A Peasant's War, War and Death. I spoke to the curator of the exhibition, Star Figura. Star, Kitta Kollwitz has actually been in the MoMA collection since 1934. She was an artist who achieved fame in her lifetime, but this is the first big survey, so it's been a long time coming.
Yes, there was one other major international survey in 1992 at the National Gallery in Washington. But this is the first time since then that an exhibition has gathered together some of the most outstanding works from different collections in the United States and in Europe. And it's the first time ever in New York that there's a major museum retrospective of Kitta Kollwitz, which is kind of an astonishing thing to think about.
It really is. How would you say that her reputation has changed in that time? Because in the catalogue, you quote Clement Greenberg talking about her excess and so on. And now I just don't think anybody would dare say anything like that about Kitta Kollwitz to a certain degree.
Yeah, I think her reception has, you know, gone up and down a little bit. It ebbs a bit with the political social climate. So in the 30s and 40s, when the United States was very much against fascism and in Europe, she was held up as a kind of a model for that. Mm. And she became very popular. And a lot of emigres from Germany and from Europe brought Kitta Kollwitz's works with them. And so they were available to collectors in the United States. And she became quite well known in this country at that time, which was still during her lifetime. But then after World War II, with the rise of abstract expressionism and a more formalist emphasis in contemporary art criticism, I think she went a little bit out of favor, at least with the mainstream art world. She still had many aficionados among collectors and others in the art world. And then she resurged again, I would say, in the 70s with the feminist movement and the anti-war movement and the civil rights movement. She became another touchstone for artists and for, you know, leftist political movements. And then again, I think that waned a little bit in more recent decades. But now I think it's wonderful to reintroduce her at this time when her attention to the social, the political, to an art of social advocacy, her images just seem more relevant and resonant than ever, the way she positioned women in her images as well.
And I think that's absolutely right to say about what we're seeing in the news media on a daily basis and how much that was absolutely her extraordinary concern. And she had that extraordinary sensitivity to bring the human into a political situation, deeply political person, but always presented the personal and the intimate within the context of a political situation, didn't she?
Exactly. Her work is deeply, deeply personal, but she was always able to connect it to a more universal message. So even if her position was sort of leftist, even beyond that, it wasn't just about the working class. It was messages for everybody and really the human experience.
And she had this amazing phrase where she said she felt she had a duty to voice the sufferings of people. And she talked about how her art had purpose. You know, she really felt that art did more than just present an image to people for contemplation. She wanted it to have a social purpose, right?
Absolutely. That was her mission. She wanted to make a difference, and she grew up in a family of socialists, and she knew she had a talent, and she felt it was her duty to use it to make the world a better place.
And in terms of how quickly that surfaced in her work, when did she begin those images that really began to confront issues and to confront the political and social situation?
From the very beginning. You know, she started her career in Berlin in the early 1890s. And by the late 1890s, she made her first major print portfolio, A Weaver's Revolt, which was a series that told a story of a revolt in Silesia, part of Central Europe. And yeah, it was an extremely political statement at that time. So from the very beginning, she was using her art to make a political statement and to champion the cause of the working class.
You've mentioned already that idea of putting the woman front and center and how amazingly clearly she did that and with such uncompromising commitment to that. And you see it right the way through in every single sequence of works. There is woman front and center. And it's amazing how much variety actually there is that she conjures in terms of that incredible pathos, but also sensitivity to the form of woman that she shows right the way through her career.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, even in this first series, if you think about images of revolution, uprising, you know, she was looking at the history of art and it printed images at people like Goya. And images of uprisings or revolutions typically center on men, right? They're the ones who are leading the charge. But in her images, of course, there are men, there are crowds of people, but there's always a woman kind of front and center. And sometimes it's that woman is a mother. She's holding a child even as she's, you know, storming the gates of the employer's home. So it's really remarkable. She's arguably the first to put women forward to such a powerful and influential degree. And at this critical time when women's rights are being pushed forward in a way that they never have been before.
You mentioned Goya there. She had a strong conviction that she wanted to be among the greats. Is that right? So she would deliberately put herself within the ranks of Rembrandt and Goya and Dürer, and like even her self-portraits, for instance. There's a terrific confidence about them. She wanted to be in their company.
I think so. I mean, we know that she was going and looking at the old masters. She traveled to Italy. She traveled to Paris. She saw the contemporary masters in Paris. She went to the Kupferstich cabinet, the great print cabinet in Berlin, and looked at old master prints there. And I think when you look at even her early works, the techniques that she uses, I mean, there's a lot of hatching and just the line work, the hatching, the different types of strokes. It's just absolutely extraordinary, especially from the very, very beginning. And I think it was important to her to, in order to get her point across, she had to make sure that her art was so great that it was undeniable.
And it's interesting that that undeniability immediately created a sort of sense of danger about what she was doing, in the sense that, you know, the German state immediately spotted what she was up to a certain degree and were suspicious of it, weren't they? Because she was denied awards because they recognized that she was being critical of the state and in an active way, in a way that other artists were sort of veiling that sort of content, right?
Exactly, yes. So that portfolio we were just talking about, A Weaver's Revolt, in 1898, she entered it into a kind of a state-sponsored juried art competition. And the jury, which included the leading artists of the day, such as Adolf Menzel, awarded her the gold medal, which is extraordinary for this woman, brand new on the scene, and they award her the medal. I mean, that speaks to how great her work was. But she didn't get the medal because it was a state-sponsored competition, and the Kaiser vetoed the award, saying medals belong on the breasts of deserving men. So it was both the fact that she was a woman and also this kind of subversive socialist content, which they were very, very concerned would foment social discontent, which was actually what she wanted. And as you said, you know, other artists, I think, would have veiled that content, but she didn't. That's how bold she was.
And she achieved a certain level of success at that point, of course, but the big success came with the next big cycle of prints, didn't it? The Peasants' War, which was the series made in the early 20th century.
Yes. So building on the success of that first portfolio, she started work on another one, which was a more ambitious portfolio. The plates are much, much larger. They're really quite large for etching plates at that time. And she becomes even more experimental in her printmaking techniques, incorporates all kinds of unusual methods and textures. So they're really marvelous works of etching and printmaking. And the subject, A Peasant's War, she's looking to history. So she read this history of a 16th century uprising of, you know, the farmers and people who worked the land on feudal estates rising up against their feudal overlords. So it's a story about that across seven plates. It moves from an image of like beast of burden plowing the fields to the kind of inciting incident, which is the rape of a woman. So there's this tough image of a woman who's just been raped. And again, it's the circumstances of a woman that it sort of is the linchpin of the revolt in Katie Kollwitz's telling. And then it goes to images of a woman leading the charge. and then a woman on the battlefield when the revolution is crushed, but it's a mother looking for her child on the battlefield. So again, bringing it back to women and the pain that they experience from this kind of social conflict. So it was a major series. She spent 6 years working on these 7 plates. She got a commission from a Society for Historical Art. So they were able to publish it in a very large edition of 300, which is really, really large. And they circulated it to their membership. Right. And then there were other copies available to circulate even more broadly. So she had already become known in the art world from her first portfolio, but then this expanded her renown even beyond the kind of inner circles of the art world.
And you mentioned there about the mother looking for their son, their child on the battlefield. She'd also made that extraordinary Pieta in 1903. She had made The Woman with Dead Child. So she was already concerned with images of mothers and their dead children, even before her own son tragically died in the First World War. And we tend to think of that's almost like the most famous incident in her biography. But what's interesting is that she was already preoccupied with that subject long before it actually became a terrible reality in her own life, right?
Yeah, exactly. She was preoccupied with that subject. And I think there are a couple of reasons. We have a really nice essay in our catalog by Dorothy Price about this imagery and those reasons. But one reason is that childhood mortality at that time was very, very high in Germany. It was about 30%. And part of that was due to there was no modern medicine like we have today. There's no penicillin yet. But it was also thanks to the Industrial Revolution, there was major overcrowding in Berlin and major poverty, and that bred disease. And so in any given family, this was likely a reality. So that was one thing. So these images of individual mothers grieving an individual child are part of a distillation of a broad, vast social problem. But they're also, I think, have a personal genesis in her biography, which is that when she was a child, her mother actually lost 3 children as very young children. Mm. 2 of them before Kollwitz was born, but one of them who was her younger brother, Benjamin, who was just a very small child and died from an illness when Kollwitz was a very young girl. And the memory of her mother's suffering and the change in her mother that happened after that, I think, affected her for the rest of her life.
Absolutely. And of course, the death of her son in, I think it was the first 10 days of him being enlisted to go to war in the First World War, haunted her too for the rest of her life, didn't it? And partly because there's this terrible fact that she persuaded her husband to give him permission to go. So there was, it wasn't just about grief. It was also about a certain level of guilt on her part that haunted her, as I say, you know, for the rest of her life.
Yeah. So as you said, you know, that's her most iconic image, I think, from 1903, The Woman with Dead Child. People often think of it as this kind of premonition of what would happen in her own life in 1914. So what, 11 years later, her 18-year-old son, Peter, enlists for the First World War. He is underage, so he needs his parents' permission. And Kollwitz convinces her husband that they should give it to him. And within about 2 weeks of leaving, he's killed on the battlefield in Belgium. So yes, as you said, there's grief and there's guilt.
And she channels that in all sorts of ways. On the one hand, there's this very famous sculpture that she makes called Grieving Parents, but also the series simply called War, which she takes a long time to process the information before making. It's really instructive because on the one hand, it's a marker of her own changing attitude towards war because, you know, at the start of the First World War, in a sense, she had a sense of the nationalist spirit to protect the nation and so on. But by the time she makes that series in the early 20s, her attitude to war is utterly changed because of what's happened to her personally and because of what she's seen affecting so many other families.
Absolutely. What she's seen affecting so many other families, her own personal experience, and what she comes to understand as sort of the callousness of the German state. And, you know, towards the end of the war, there's a push to conscript ever younger young men, children, for the war effort. And these things basically turn her towards pacifism. She becomes a pacifist, which, as she says, it's very difficult to be a pacifist. It's not just a passive position. It's sort of an active position. And in that portfolio War, which she creates. She works on them between 1922, 1923. So it's her sort of memorial to the war and to the suffering and the pain experienced, especially by those who were left behind. So not the war of the battlefield, but the war of the home front. So it's, again, like she's putting this different point of view that hasn't traditionally been put forward in art history. And when you look through the cycle, I think you see very much a trajectory of her own move towards pacifism. So by the end, one of the last sheets is this amazing image of a group of women sort of huddled together in a kind of pose of solidarity. And they're shielding these little children beneath them. It's called the Mothers. And I think it's really an image of resistance, against the nationalism and militarism of German culture that called for mothers to stoically sacrifice their children. And she was no longer okay with that.
She then, of course, went on to create the series Death, which is made during the National Socialist period. So is it right that she was interviewed by the Gestapo as a socialist, obviously, and also was sort of threatened with being put in a concentration camp and so on? So she experienced direct interference in her life from the National Socialists.
She did, yes, because just before they came to power, she was one of the few people who signed an appeal for unity, which was basically like a public letter saying the factions of the left, the socialists and the communists especially, need to come together because they were fighting against each other and dividing the vote. Basically, she's saying we have to come together in order to defeat the National Socialists. Well, it didn't work, but you know, her name was on that letter. And as a result, yes, she was prevented from exhibiting her work. She was forced to resign from her position as a professor at the Prussian Academy of Art, which was the leading art school in Germany. She was the first woman appointed professor there in 1919. She was forced to resign as a result of her position. And she was interrogated, as you said, by the Gestapo and threatened with removal to a concentration camp. So yes, she very much experienced intimidations during that period.
And that series Death is absolutely indicative of the struggles of somebody witnessing what was happening to Germany at that time and again applying it to her own life.
Right. I mean, it's a couple of things. Again, you know, death was a theme that preoccupied her from the very beginnings. So in a way, it's a kind of a culmination of this dominant theme throughout her oeuvre. But I think it's also a personal culmination. You know, she knows she's getting older. She's 70 when she completes that portfolio, I think in 1937. And she knows she's tired. So I think, you know, you can't help but read it as a sort of warning to what's happening under National Socialism, but also as a personal statement, culmination, and a kind of acceptance of what's probably coming for her.
She was not an expressionist in terms that we might understand in relation to Die Brücke and Der Blaue Reiter. So she wasn't part of the groups, but she's often called an expressionist artist. Where does she sit in that field, if you like? How does she relate to the official expressionism that's being seen elsewhere in Germany?
Well, she's a German artist, you know, working in the early 20th century, and her work is extremely emotional and expressive. In that sense, you know, she's often linked to expressionism, but I would say she's a little bit older than most of the expressionist artists. You know, they're born, say, like around 1880. She's born 1867. So she sort of comes of age, as I said, in the 1890s. Expressionism doesn't really emerge until 1905 at the earliest. Really 1910 is kind of the peak moment of expressionism. And she wasn't involved in the groups around the expressionists. She sort of forged her own path and was more connected to a sort of an older generation of artists like Max Liebermann, who was her great champion and mentor, connected to the Berlin Secession, which is just a different circle than the expressionists. You know, we think of expressionism as it's figurative art, but it's a little bit abstracted. And there's different factions of expressionism. You know, Kandinsky and Franz Marc were more abstract. Ernst Ludwig Kirchner and Erich Heckel were more figurative. But they're leaning more towards abstraction and formal experimentation. where she really sticks with figuration. She wants her work to be very legible so that it is accessible to the broadest spectrum of the public, you know, and she says at one point, I think it's around 1916, 1917, she compares herself to Schmidt Rottluff, one of the Die Brücke artists. She recognizes that that's not what she's doing, because she says, you know, I'm content that my art has purposes. I want to make a difference in this time. So it's important to her that her work is very, very legible. And she felt that expressionism was just a little bit too abstract and maybe not accessible to the public outside the art world. But the other thing is, she doesn't make woodcuts, and expressionism is very much associated with the woodcut. She doesn't make woodcuts until the 1920s. She had resisted it. It wasn't her medium. She did like all those detail intensive etchings. And then in the 20s with that war portfolio, she tries woodcuts because it's so bold and she wants her message to be bold and punchy. So she does start to incorporate some expressionist style into her work, but not until the 1920s, when actually expressionism is sort of on the wane.
Star, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Kitta Kollwitz is at the Museum of Modern Art in New York from the 31st of March to the 20th of July. There are two European shows of Kollwitz's work this year, at the Stedel Museum in Frankfurt until the 9th of June, and at SMK, the National Gallery of Denmark, in Copenhagen from the 7th of November to the 25th of February 2025. While Kitta Kollwitz developed her form of expressionist art independently, as Star Figura has said, there were two communities of artists that form what we understand officially as German expressionism: Die Brücke, or The Bridge, based in Dresden, and Der Blaue Reiter, or The Blue Rider, based in Munich. This latter loose gathering of artists and other cultural figures is the subject of a new exhibition at Tate Modern, Expressionists: Kandinsky, Munter, and The Blue Rider, opening in April. It focuses on the international nature of the artists who gathered in Bavaria in the early 1910s, and the key role of partnerships and friendships in the development of their ideas, including the one between Wassily Kandinsky and Gabriele Munter that is mentioned in the title. Indeed, Munter and other women artists in the movement, including Maria Frank Mark and Mariana Verevkin, are given greater attention in the Tate Show than in previous surveys. I spoke to Natalia Sidlina, the curator of the exhibition. Natalia, I wanted to begin by asking if we can still define the expressionist movement by its two best-known groups, as in Die Brücke and Der Blaue Reiter, which your show is focusing on. Are those still useful groups by which to judge the whole movement, if you like?
I think if you ask general public what comes to mind when you hear expressionism, they would probably think of the dramatic forms, sort of angst of early silent cinema, fractured compositions, atonal music, maybe a bit of free poetry. So I don't think people would be thinking in terms of art historical categories, groupings and formations and affiliations between different collectives. So for art historians, I think those categories are still in place. So the Blaue Reiter and Die Brücke are two groups, two collectives, which usually we are talking about when we mention German expressionists, but it's much more than that. We, of course, have Kitta Kollwitz, we, of course, have the Wuppertaler group, we, of course, have Paula Modersohn Becker, all those incredibly interesting and important female artists who worked within the movement we associate with expressionists, but don't fall into any of those two categories.
Right.
So for art historians, probably yes. For general public, I think they just enjoy the incredible colours, drama, emotion and build-up and the humanity of it all.
I think that's right. Now, of course, even within the movements that we're talking about, so let's talk about your show. It's called Expressionists, and you're looking at Der Blaue Reiter. But I think it's really crucial to establish that there's so much still to discover. And just the very title of your exhibition, to me, shows the shift in how we might understand this group, because I'm pretty sure even 20 years ago, we might have had an exhibition which is called Expressionists, Kandinsky, Mark, and etc. But this time you've got Gabriele Munter where she should be, front and centre. So tell us about that.
Absolutely. So in Expressionist Kandinsky, Munter and the Blue Rider, we just wanted to spotlight a creative community that formed and worked around the early 1900s and is known under the collective title of the Blue Rider. It was the first modernist collective that proclaimed that the whole work called art knows no boundaries or nations, only humanity. So this strong transnational message is very important for us. And therefore, we'll consider the Blue Rider circle of artists as they grappled with the same concerns and issues the current generation of the 21st century creatives and artists struggle with or grapple with. It's multiple identities, fluid sexuality, migratory experiences, ethnic intolerance, well, everyday chauvinism, war and its trauma. All of the artists were affected by the dramatic events of the early 20th century. They express them through sort of boundless experimentation and radicalism and introduced polymath practices. So we will spotlight just 17 of artists associated with the Blue Rider Circle. They were painters, performers, musicians, and with regards to the affiliations and what brought them all together, we wanted to start with the core couple of Vasily Kandinsky and Gabriele Munter, which was at the core of the collective and started bringing people together much earlier than more celebrated duet of Kandinsky and Mark.
Right.
So it will give us opportunity to tell the stories of friendships and collaborations, of spiritual quest and artistic experimentation, which was at the heart of the Blue Rider project.
Of course, the important thing about the Blue Rider is that it's not just located in one place, is it? In the sense that, yes, it's Munich, but it's also this incredibly crucial, more rural space, which is Murnau. And that's where a lot of the kind of ideas that eventually formed the Blue Rider began and developed. And tell us about Murnau and its significance to the movement.
I absolutely agree with you. The potential of space is very important for the Blue Rider. And we actually start the exhibition much earlier. And even outside of the traditional European context, we start with the two experiences which both Munter and Kandinsky treasured throughout all their creative lives as the creative impulse which transformed people who didn't have much to do with art into one of the most celebrated modernist artists of the period. So we start with Kandinsky's journey into the southeast provinces of the former Russian Empire to the land of indigenous Azeriani people, or Komi as they self-identify, and Munter's journey to her roots, to the land where her mother came from, where her parents met, and where the Munter family started, to the US. And Kandinsky witnessed the incredible vernacular culture of the Komi people, which influenced him all his life. And this is something he acknowledges in his very programmatic later statements, in which he builds his mythology. And Munter buys her first roll film camera, Kodak Bullseye number 2, and starts taking photographs. So we know her primarily as a painter, but this incredible eye for detail and the complex ironic composition actually came from experience of experimental photographer. And then we take various people who made this incredibly maverick, misfit group of artists who came from all over the world, gradually to Munich. So we have Yevlensky and Vorovkin, who came from the former Russian Empire. We have the Burluks, who came from Ukraine, as well as Elizabeth Epstein and Sonia Delaunay, also came from Ukraine. We have Robert Delaunay, who was brought in by a very strong woman in the heart of the Blair Writer Project by Elizabeth Epstein and Sonia Delaunay. In the fall of the Blau Writer, we have Mark, who is the only member of the circle who actually came from Munich. Right. And of course, other artists who came from the US, like Liner Feininger or Albert Bloch, and from other parts of Germany. Claire, who came from Switzerland, Bossi, who came from Austria-Hungary, now Croatia, then Italy. So we have people coming from all those different places. And that actually the key difference between the two groups which come to mind when we talk about expressionism, Blue Rider and Die Brücke. Die Brücke was very firmly a structured group based in one place, while the Blau Rider came from all over the world.
Right, and you're really emphasising that, aren't you? This transcultural, transnational identity that the group had, and also that sense that you've identified as a kind of slightly maverick group of people, in the sense that you can't really say that there's a Blau Rider style, can you? It's very diverse, even between the protagonists. There are very distinctive elements in their particular practices.
You're absolutely right. And what incredible about Blau Rider, and this is what makes them so relatable to the artists who are active today, is that they came together not through the similarity of backgrounds or through education or through the manner or style they identify with. Their bonds are those of friendship, brotherhood, sisterhood of spirit, and common task. This is why we're not talking about them as a group. We're talking about them as creative community. They came together, they didn't set any parameters, there was no membership, there was no selective committee for the exhibition, there was no manifesto, so to speak, to identify them as a bound by boundaries and common goals group. It was truly collective, linked by friendship and mutual understanding.
That's really interesting. And it emerged from an earlier group, didn't it? The NVKM. And it's really important to distinguish those two things because many of these artists were part of that. But one of the key distinguishing factors is that there was a sort of rejection of Kandinsky's abstraction. Is that right? Or at least that was a sort of catalyzing event which made the Blau Rider come into being.
Absolutely. Neue Künstlervereinigung München is the New Artist Association of Munich, quite a progressive group association, which was formed around manifesto, committees, chairmanship, and so on and so forth. But it was open to women artists, which meant that the artists like Vorovkin and Epstein could exhibit with them and start selling their works and promote their art.
And totally equally as well, right? So it, from the establishment right from the start.
Yeah. Absolutely equal footing. They also draw in their remit not only visual artists, but composers like Thomas von Hartmann. And of course, the performer Alexander Sakharov was very much supported by NKVM and was able to develop as a freestyle performer within the NKVM. And you're absolutely right. The pretext for withdrawing works from the third NKVM exhibition in December 1911 for Kandinsky and Mark, who joined just a few months before that, was the rejection of non-figuration by the committee. Because there was such a sort of strongly set boundaries, the official objection to removal of the Kandinsky work wasn't the composition or that it was non-figurative, but the fact that the size of it was slightly bigger than the one outlined in the manifesto of the association. So you can see why Blau Rider was really keen on getting rid of all those boundaries, open up and see where pure creativity and the camaraderie of spirit will take them.
You mentioned the word spirit there, and I think that's crucial, isn't it? Because there's this phrase which is used by Mark, which is about the inner desire of the artist. And that's what, again, if there is something uniting them, it's to get in touch with some sort of emotional or spiritual core at the heart of their own practices, which unites them with these very diverse other artists.
Absolutely right. This is what Kandinsky called inner sound. And Mark talked about the art which concerned with most profound matters, that renewal must not be merely formal, but rebirth of thinking. So that's rebirth of thinking. Inner sound is at the core of their experimentation. And again, another parameter which sets them apart from Die Brücke artists. So yes, spirituality was very important for the artists, because they thought that the spiritual renewal goes hand in hand with social renewal, and a revolution of spirit goes hand in hand in the progressive liberalist ideas they all shared.
Right. Now, one thing I wanted to clear up is, of course, the kind of renowned instigators, if you like, of the Blue Rider are Kandinsky and Mark, because their names are on the Almanac, that first publication. But is it right that several women were actually involved in producing the Almanac but did not get credited? And is that something that they accepted in their time, or was that a cause for tension within the group?
Absolutely right. I was just thinking about the time it took me to put together the catalogue for the exhibition. It was 18 months and it was incredibly hard work for everyone. We have 15 participants coming from all over the globe. We had participants from the US, from Ukraine, from Germany, from the UK, various languages, images coming from all over the place. It took the Almanac editors 11 months.
Right.
11 months before internet, before digital images, before Google Translate, before email. It's impossible for one, even two people to accomplish this task. It was that village we usually talk about. That was the village working on making the Almanac, the programmatic publication, which showcased their ideas to come to life, and everyone participated. It was basically all hands on deck. If we look at the archival materials, which we do bring into the exhibition, we see that Gabriele Munter shared the burden of correspondence with Kandinsky and Mark. We also know that the publication was only possible because it was bankrolled by Elizabeth Marquier, August Marquier's wife, uncle, who paid for it all. Kandinsky, who liked to think about himself as experienced publisher, totally underestimated the practical side of it. So it's quite fun to read practical correspondence between him and Herr Piper, the editor from Piper Verlag, the publishing house which published the Almanac. You know, completely unrealistic expectations. We know that notes were taken by Maria Frank Mark, and we know that other artists participated in debates, and the content of the Almanac, and it just happened that the names of Kandinsky and Mark were the only one credited in that publication. But it was indeed all hands on deck, a group effort, collective effort of the entire community to make it happen.
So then your exhibition and the catalogue indeed are real efforts to really establish the actual balance of authorship in the group, or as you say, not a group, but within this community, to give due credit to everybody involved, and actually for many of us to see their work in depth for the first time.
It's very hard to do it within the context of one single exhibition or one single publication. What we are doing, we are presenting an ecliptic plane, if you wish, of possibilities. So if you think of it as a planetary system, we create those constellations and groups of stars and planets which are in each other's orbit and work with each other very closely.
But at the same time, though, still, like for a big group exhibition of this kind, it feels like a moment where you can at least establish a kind of balance, more of a balance. I can understand that it's got to be partial, but to a certain extent, you are bringing a certain level of parity with the people that you have selected in the show.
Of course. And it's the first time the project is centered around the collective. It's multiple histories as well as contradictions and its interpersonal dynamics.
Well, Natalia, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast.
Thank you so much, Ben. It was a pleasure.
Expressionists, Kandinsky, Munter and the Blue Rider is at Tate Modern in London from the 25th of April to the 20th of October. Gabriele Munter, the great expressionist woman painter, is at the Tisa Borna Misa Museum in Madrid from the 12th of November until the 9th of February 2025. Further expressionist exhibitions this year include The Anxious Eye, German Expressionism and Its Legacy at the National Gallery of Art in Washington, D.C. until the 27th of May, Munk to Kirchner, the Heinz Collection of Modern and Expressionist Art at the Dallas Museum of Art in Texas in the US until the 5th of January next year, Munk and Kirchner, Anxiety and Expression at the Yale University Art Gallery in New Haven in Connecticut in the US until the 23rd of June, and Eric Heckel at the Museum of Fine Arts in Ghent in Belgium from the 12th of October until the 25th of January next year. And that's it for this episode. You can find us on X, formerly known as Twitter, at Town Audio, and on Facebook, Instagram, and Threads. The Week in Art is produced by Julia Mahowska, Alexander Morrison, and David Clack, and David's also the editor and sound designer. Thanks also to Daniela Hathaway and to our guests, Donna, Star, and Natalia. And thank you for listening. We'll see you next week. Bye for now.